That's the question. Are you all right, Tim?
Yeah.
Good sound. Over to you.
Thank you.
Hi, that was unexpectedly fast. My name's Tim, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
And thank you for asking me. And thank you, Yvette. That was lovely. And it's good to be here. And yeah, I love this fellowship. It very quickly became the most important thing in my life, and has stayed the centre of my life for 30 years, a few hours longer than Yvette, but only just. So, where shall I start? Right at the end of my drinking, a typical day for me. My first marriage had broken up. I'd lost contact with my children. I was living in a bedsit above an Indian restaurant, sleeping on a mattress on the floor. I was cross-addicted to drugs and alcohol. I'd lost contact with my family. I'd certainly lost contact with all friends who I'd either cut off, or they'd cut me off, or I'd ripped them off, or whatever it was. And I'd come to throughout, it was the final few months were over the summer, and I'd come to when it got light at 5 o'clock, whatever time it was in the morning. And the first thing I'd feel was absolute terror and panic, and how did my life get to this point? I didn't die overnight. What on earth can I do to get through the next 12 hours? And I was, most days, I would just grab a handful of what were then, I can't remember what they were called, blue tranquilizers. And I'd swallow four or five of those, and I'd lie on the mattress till the panic had subsided sufficiently for me to think that I could get off the mattress and try and force down the first drink. And that obviously assumed that there was alcohol in the house, which most of the time there was. Occasionally there wasn't, and that was the real terror day when I had to somehow get out of the house and get alcohol before I could, you know. And most of the time, if I had it, I'd drink vodka, and I'd pour out a glass of vodka, which occasionally I'd top up with orange juice, because I thought that was healthy, vitamin C. And I'd put the plug in the sink, and I'd try to force that first drink down in sips, knowing that most of the time I'd throw up, and I'd have to pick the pills that I'd taken out of the sink and try to swallow them again, because I couldn't get through the day without them. And eventually I'd get that first drink down, and it would stay down, and the whole vicious circle started again. And I was back into 24 hours of doing what I had to do to get hold of alcohol, because I just did not believe that I could get through a day without drinking, without being continually topped up. And it was a complete nightmare. And I was full of fear, and I could see no way out. And I was at the jumping off point that the big book talks about. And every night I passed out, I hoped I wasn't going to wake up in the morning. And I was 32 years old, and I thought my life was completely and utterly over. And in a fairly circuitous way, I found AA, and all of that was lifted from me. That total obsession was lifted from me over the space of 3 or 4 days. And I, for me, that was a miracle. You know, that was the most incredible thing that this fellowship has ever done. And I didn't set out to become that kind of drinker. I actually just set out to have a good time, really. there was, you know, no reason why I should have been an alcoholic. You know, none of my brothers or sisters are alcoholics. My parents aren't or weren't. My father died this year. Weren't alcoholics. You know, I had a kind of typical middle class upbringing with, you know, with caring parents or reasonably caring parents, you know, for their generation, and good schools and all the rest of it. But I suppose I look back, and the one thing that I really remember feeling as a young child and as a teenager was a sense of anxieties that I couldn't understand, fears that I couldn't explain, a kind of a sense of dis-ease with the world. You know, I can remember being terrified going to a children's party, and I couldn't have been more than six, and just not wanting to go because it was just too scary to go. And I remember being sent away to school when I was 10, and being absolutely terrified to find myself in a school hundreds of miles away from family, where nobody, I knew nobody, in what was even then a pretty rough regime, or harsh regime, I suppose. At 14, 15, I can remember throwing up most mornings, because I just felt I couldn't deal with the world. And I now understand that as the isms of the disease. And when I discovered alcohol, it went away. It was wonderful. And I so vividly remember the first time I went into a pub and with three or four people, and managed to actually buy a pint over the bar, and it was, I think, 1 and 6 pence or something. And it felt great. And two or three weeks later was New Year's Eve, and I spent it with two friends at a pub in a town called Portishead, which is where my family were then living, and I probably had, I don't know, three, maybe even four pints, and it was wonderful. This was the solution to how I felt. All of that pain, you know, all of that fear that had increasingly dominated me as a child was removed, and I just knew that's the solution from now onwards to my life. If I can drink, I feel fine. I can do anything. I can go anywhere. And that's really what I tried to do for the next 15 or so years. I discovered drugs fairly quickly after that. And, you know, this is AA, so it's about alcohol. But, you know, drugs were very much part of my story. You know, as to be honest, they are for a lot of people who come in to AA, and increasingly so. And I had periods of cross addiction. You know, I probably had two or three years of heroin addiction, which was bad. And I used I used alcohol a lot to deal with the withdrawal from that. But kind of ultimately, I view alcohol as my drug of choice, because I managed to, you know, I stopped using cocaine when I was spending thousands of pounds a month, and I just couldn't afford it. You know, I stopped taking heroin when I realised that I couldn't function, but I couldn't stop taking alcohol, and that was the continuous, you know, my continuous drug right through to the very end. So I left school, and I went. I spent a bit of time trying to work out what I wanted to do, and I ended up working as a journalist, which was one of those, looking back now, and I frequently hear people say their job was a perfect job for drinking, but trust me, journalism was a perfect job for drinking. And I worked on local straight, normal straight newspapers, and then on music papers, and then on film papers, and you could just drink as much as you wanted to, really, all the time, and most of the time it was paid for by other people, and you thought you, I certainly thought I had power without obviously having any responsibility. And for probably 4 or 5 years it was actually pretty good fun. You know, and I went to lots of places and I did lots of things, and you know, and I was within a kind of a circle of people who were behaving in the same way, and it wasn't that obvious that that I was an alcoholic. I mean, in fact, looking back now, there were lots of people that I drank and used with during those days who are, you know, today are either dead or they're in AA. And a few of them who were certainly people that I comfortably drank with, and a few of them are still drinking, are not dead, and are perhaps not full-blown alcoholics, merely abusers of alcohol. And it worked for a while, and it was okay. And I got married in my mid-20s to a wonderful, wild, fun girl who was 4 or 5 years younger than me, who and you know, we both just kind of behaved crazily for 4 or 5 years, and we had 2 children who were both in their 30s now. You know, sadly, she died 4 or 5 years ago from cirrhosis. And you know, I never kind of felt she was that bad, but you know, clearly, you know, her body got to the point where she couldn't continue by the time she got into her 50s. And you know, work wise I kind of started leaving jobs before I got fired, and then I started getting my timing completely fucked up and getting fired before I managed to leave. And you know, bad things started to happen, and I kind of think of my drinking as, I'm sure lots of you have seen the Max Glatt chart, you know, that goes, well, I know you have, which goes all the way down. You know, you've got a whole series of things, and it gets to a squiggly bit at the bottom with a big arrow that says chronic alcoholic. And pretty well everything on that chart happened to me. You know, my drinking moved from psychological addiction to physical addiction. You know, there was a point probably 3-4 years before the end of my drinking where I stopped. I just gave up trying to get through to lunchtime without a drink, and had a drink immediately I came to in the morning. And you know, it was just, I can't function without having something that's going to calm me and stop the shakes. And you know, the deterioration and the progression was, you know, all the classics, you know, from beer and wine to scotch to vodka, because it obviously doesn't smell, to whatever I can get my hands on. And you know, the marriage started to get pretty explosive, you know, it was full of arguments and craziness and things getting broken. Never really any violence. I can remember smashing open our electricity meter to get money out, because I needed money for drugs. We had 2 kids who, as I said, who really, you know, if you said to me, how do you feel about them? I'd have said, I love them unconditionally, but I didn't. you know, I had to put my addiction ahead of, I had no real choice, I guess, to put my addiction ahead of anything else. And I just knew that I had to have what I had to have. The marriage eventually split up, and it took me another 2 years roughly from that point to get to this fellowship. And those 2 years were really just a steady progression of it getting worse and worse and worse, and, you know, losing the house we owned and renting a house that I didn't pay the rent on and getting evicted. A couple of insane, crazy relationships with other people, trying to maintain some kind of contact with my children, but finding it increasingly impossible, and sinking into that kind of final 6 months or so that I talked about at the beginning, which was crazy and was just complete insanity. And I never had any difficulty accepting my insanity of step two when I came to this fellowship, because it was so clearly everyone around me knew what the problem was. If I was fleetingly honest with myself, I knew what the problem was, and I couldn't stop drinking. An old friend of my father's, who at that point had been in this fellowship, I think 15, 20 years, something like that, came to see me. And I didn't realise what he was doing at the same time, but he 12-stepped me, and got me to go to the Beaconsfield Tuesday meeting, which was then my nearest meeting. And I went for about 3 weeks, I think, and I drank before the meeting and I drank after the meeting, and I heard somebody in the meeting saying, only we can decide if we're alcoholics. So I kind of thought, okay, that's all right. I'm not. And I had another couple of months worth of drinking. And the same guy, Peter McKenna, helped me through his work, human resources or whatever it was called at that point, get into a treatment centre. And, you know, lots of us get into this fellowship without treatment centres. That was probably good for me at that point, because it took me out of circulation, it took me out of society. You know, I was effectively locked up for 7 or 8 weeks. You know, it was the beginning of the rest of my life, to replay a cliche. And I had no idea what to expect, really. I was told that it was kind of like a rest home, and it was a big country house overlooking the sea, overlooking the Bristol Channel, and I'll take my squash racket, I'll pack a swimming costume. And if I'd known what it was really like, what it was going to be like, I probably wouldn't have gone. But, you know, it was a wonderful beginning of a journey. And I think what, you know, it was a good and still is a good 12-step, no-nonsense treatment centre where they shove you in dormitories and... you know, and if you fraternize, you're out, and you know, it was. I still have lots of. I've been back a few times over the years, and it's one of a group of very good 12-step treatment centers in this country. And what I got, I think, looking back now, is I got a number of things. Number one, I was taught that I had a disease, and that alcoholism was an illness, and that I wasn't a fundamentally evil person or a fundamentally weak person. I was somebody who had an illness, and that from that point onwards, I could start getting better and I could change my life. I also got, for the first time, real hope that I could do that. And I didn't realise it at the time, but looking back now, I think what happened was I met and talked with other alcoholics who were, you know, a day, a week, a month further down the line than me, who had comfortably stopped drinking. And I shared with them and identified, although again I wouldn't have called it identification at that point, and that reduced the feeling of difference that I had probably all my life to a sufficient level for me to believe and take on faith what they said to me when they explained, this is what we've done and we've stayed sober. And it's working, and that created a huge sense of hope for me. And you know, I worked through steps 1 to 5 during those 7 or 8 weeks, and I did a step 4 and 5 that was full of holes. That was probably best to the best of my ability at that point in time. And I came out. I came out knowing two things. I think knowing that, and really totally accepting these two things. One, that I was categorically an alcoholic, and that if I drank again, I would die. And secondly, that if I wanted to stay sober and therefore not die, the most important, or in to be honest, the only thing I needed to do was to go to AA meetings. And that, I guess, is really all I've done from that point onwards. I've never stopped going to AA meetings. I do 2 or 3 meetings a week. Still these days, I have a, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 meetings a week for the first year or so. I did the, and I think I was sufficiently beaten and defeated to do all the things that I was told that I had to do. And I was told I had to get service, and I was told that I needed to get a sponsor, and I got a guy called Mac as my first sponsor, who you'll probably remember, and he then went AWOL. And his sponsor, Pat Boyle, became my sponsor. And then when Pat died, his sponsor, Terry Connor, became my sponsor. So I've been kind of locked in this group of people who are incredibly committed to this fellowship, incredibly committed to service, and you know, have a very strong, clear-cut linear view of how this fellowship works. For me, that I suppose that's manifested itself the most in service. And you know, it's 10 years since I did anything formal in terms of service. You know, obviously with obviously I do chairs and help in various areas and sponsor some people and things like that, but I had nearly 20 years of continuous structured service where I did group and I did intergroup and I did region and I did conference and I did conventions and I did the board and I stopped. And probably looking back, to be honest now, I was quite ambitious about the process, and once I was on that path, I kind of felt that, you know, my sponsors were patting me on the back as I achieved inverted commas various things over the years. But, you know, ultimately it was so good for me, and I made so many close friends and so many people that I'm still close to today because of the things we and the AA work we did together. And I think it's helped me understand a lot of stuff, and it helped me understand, you know, quite a lot about me. Although I think I learned a lot more about myself when I came to the end of that 20 years than I probably did during those 20 years. You're focused on service, it's easier to avoid looking at certain things in your own life. But it was a good experience. I think it's part of the magic of this fellowship, and why this fellowship works is that it's one person passing something on to another person, and it's all of us trying to give a little bit back that's been given to us. Action is, I know I feel better in myself when I'm taking action, and I'm going to meetings and I'm doing AA things than if I'm not. my life generally as well kind of evolved throughout all of those years. My young kids grew up and got huge amounts from both of them, particularly my daughter going to Ality. So this kind of fellowship ripples out, and neither of them have had addiction problems, and they're both, in good space today. And I've got two grandchildren from my daughter, eldest daughter. I got married again 10 years into recovery, and we were together for nearly 18 years, and we separated a year or so ago, very, very amicably. And our lives still kind of, we share lots of things in our lives and have two teenage children from that marriage. And that was, that was ultimately, I think, the right progression. And when we separated, I had a period where I went through counselling and I looked at some of the stuff in myself that I don't think I'd ever looked at. In fact, if you'd asked me 10 years earlier, do you understand codependency? And if you come to terms with codependency, I said, oh, absolutely. I get it. But I don't think I had. And certainly going through that counselling really helped me understand that in a different way. And there was also some childhood stuff that I went back and looked at, and that was a very, very good process. And I think the things that have happened over the last year, 2 years, have actually, and I'm only just becoming fully aware of this now, have actually got me to a better place than I think I've ever been in recovery. I feel more comfortable with myself than I ever have. I feel I'm enjoying living by myself again for the first time for a long time. I have lovely relationships with all four of my children. I was my 14-year-old and I were watching Wasps rugby in Coventry yesterday with her cheering and shouting, and my 17-year-old is probably one of us, we can see the early signs of addiction in her. I just wish she'd decide what her addiction was, which would be a lot help easier to start identifying what we do about it. But, you know, she's fundamentally a lovely child, and I love her. You know, work-wise, I've had an interesting time. You know, I've had some, you know, I went and started working for myself when I got sober, which I think is probably, or my sponsor says it's because I was entirely unemployable. And I've done a number of my own businesses, and you know, there've been some really good things, and you know, we've done some good stuff, and we've had some hard times. And one of the other things I'm doing at the moment is I'm moving from the business I've been doing for the last 14-15 years into something quite different, which just actually feels so much more comfortable and so much less pressure than the business in particular for the last 10 years or so has been. And that again feels like I'm getting to a good conclusion point on it. I've had a few health issues over the years. I had a heart attack when I was 39, which I thought was totally outrageous, as I hadn't had any drink or drugs for 7 years. But I think I'd damaged myself by huge quantities of amphetamines and cocaine and all the rest of it. And you know, I've had to look after my health, myself really, ever since, and be aware that there are certain things, particularly as I've got older, that I can and can't do. And it's been an amazing journey. You know, it has been something that I have so much gratitude for this fellowship. You know, I think this is a magical fellowship. I do not know anything in the world that changes people's lives as dramatically as AA does. And you know, we all see it day in, day out, of people coming in whose lives are shot. You know, my life was totally shot when I came into this fellowship, and bit by bit this fellowship changed the way I think, the way I feel, the way I look at life, the optimism and hope that I have. It's created a belief in a higher power of my understanding. You know, I think, you know, as Frank shared earlier, I was really uncomfortable with the concept of God, and my first concept of a higher power was a room full of AAs, and that was that felt really comfortable. And as time has gone by, that's become a God of my understanding. And I feel very comfortable with that today, and I don't know what it is, and I kind of accept why should I know what it is. You know, it's not something that is necessarily within the scope of the human mind. But what I do know is that at times of huge pressure or of confusion, if I get on my knees and I try and draw on that higher power, it works, and it calms me, and it helps me, and it helps me believe and know absolutely in my gut that whatever happens, it will be all right. And you know, that in turn has given, on the whole, a degree of peace and contentment that I never imagined I would have. And you know, as Yvette was saying, this fellowship has grown and has evolved and changed, but has ultimately stayed true, I believe, to its core roots, and its, obviously, its steps, but also its traditions. Mm-hmm. And I think if there's anything that that frustrates me today, it's despite the way that we've grown over the last 30, 40 years, we still fail to reach so many active alcoholics. And if you compare the UK today to the US, we have still only achieved a fraction of what they've achieved in terms of people in recovery. You know, what do we have in this country? We have probably 50,000 alcoholics in long-term recovery. If we were as successful in this country, and I'm not going to spend a long time sharing about why I think we haven't achieved this, but if we were as successful as America has been, we would have 400,000 people in recovery in this country, you know, per head of population. You know, I quite often go to for business to Los Angeles, and I always go to some meetings when I'm there. There is a Wednesday night meeting, the Pacific meeting in Los Angeles, every Wednesday, that is over 1,000 people every week. In Santa Monica, where I normally stay, every 7 days a week at 6 o'clock, there's what's called an after 10 meeting, which is a little bit like an old timers meeting, I suppose, but you can't share unless you're over 10 years sober. And it's normally 50 or 60 people. And the majority of those people at the meeting are over 40 years sober. And you know, you just realise the potential for what we could do in this country for this fellowship. So I certainly haven't talked for 45 minutes, but I've talked myself out, so I'm going to shut up now.
Thank you
very much, and thank you for listening to me, and it's lovely to be here.
Thank you, Tim. You got me thinking that I've never actually, loads of people I've seen die. When you said that, you know, the mother to your first two.
Yeah.
You know, because I got sober in my, excuse me. So I got sober in my 20s, you know. So I look back and my memories of the drinking are all people, you know, I've outlived so many people, you know, and that's sad, isn't it? You know, because but to actually, you know, to look at your children and possibly see the resemblance of their mum in them at times, and you're here and she's not here. You know, it's like sometimes I've gone to AA funerals.
Yeah.
And there was one particular funeral, and it's Chris, God bless his soul, and his daughter looked me in the eyes, you know, and the conversation I had with myself with her eye contact was, why are you alive and my dad's dead? You know, I can't answer, you know. And the bit there you were saying, it was so good to hear that bit there about America and AA, because I remember American, because it's funny, like you two both been here 30 years, because my oldest girl was just turned 30, and I was sort of, when the wife was pregnant at that time, I sort of dropped back out of AA a bit. I just kept local, you with me, you know. And there was an American fella, and he said to me, we got it too easy over here. He said, this NHS does you no favours. He said, there's no safety. He said, over in the States, like, they haven't got that safety net, and it swim or sink straight away, you know. And I've always remembered that, and I think it's sad that, and it was nice to hear you saying that, you know, because sometimes, sometimes you think you're the only one that feels that way, you know. I think Frank's gone now. I don't know the reason why. Like, say, I can remember people like Nina coming in, people like that, because Jimmy A, a fellow that was, he said to me, when you see a newcomer, like our fellow John, he's always told me, say a prayer, that if the hand of AA is out for them, he can grab it. And I always remember people, you know, and it's nice to see people that are around, you know. It's like, I've never heard you before, Tim. I've seen you around. You've always seen that sort of nice smiley fellow on the other side of the room on a Tuesday night, you with me? And I know Leon talks to you, you with me? And when you walk across the room, Leon no longer talks to me, you with me, you know? Bill backed me up, aren't you, Bill? You know, you know, grace with this smiling man, we're all non-existent now, you know? But, but I'd say one thing I got out of this weekend, right, is the overwhelming how much we all need to be loved. And the price we pay to be loved, you know, whether it's the heroin or whatever, you know, that real loneliness inside of us, you know. And it's funny, but it's like, like you've had, like you'd possibly look at me, I'm preoccupied with my life, but every time I see you, I know your story when you said that senses, when you listen, I'm with you there, you know, your senses were, you're too scared to open. I remember coming around in the A&E once, I took a right kicking, and the Irish nurse was saying, that's Timmy, my father's Tim and Norwin, as I always clued you. And they said, that's Tim Foley's boy there, you remember? And I was too, you know, I'm more worried about their opinions than the beating of them, you know, and I'm lying there that thing, thinking, Christ, how do I get out of it? And that shame straight away, isn't it? You know, and so many, you know, there's so many people dead, you know, but I mean, you know, we do. I mean, anyone that's ever listened to this in years to come, what we've got this weekend and the previous, there's a great message this weekend, isn't it? You know, and it's about feeling loved, isn't it? And in spite of us all, or whatever we are, or whatever we come from, we meet on that love, don't we? It's sort of a beautiful mutual. I'm getting all sloppy, don't I? I mean, but no, thank you, Tim. Thank you, Vet. And I've been told I've got to mention Tradition 7 just because it's good for AA. So if you've got something, if you haven't done, no, we wouldn't mention it. But yeah. I've been told because you're not doing other meetings any favours. Neil, would you like to close the meeting for us, saying the Serenity Prayer, please?
Yep, certainly. Could you join me in the Serenity Prayer using the word go as you do?
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know.
I forgot we've got to do the clap, haven't we? There's something coming this weekend, yeah. How do you turn it up, you know?
Bernie. 9/11.